From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, in Dear White People, a main character receives a stream of online hate.
How does it feel to be a target?
The oppressed are always being blamed for calling out the nature of their oppression.
It's based on what actually happened to the show's creator, Justin Simeon.
These people don't fully realize the tradition that they're actually carrying on. It's a tradition that has often turned fatal and violent and has blotted out millions of people's voices. And, you know, I'm lucky that it's just on Twitter for me.
And YouTube tries to attract older audiences. All that coming right up. When Justin Simeon's movie, Dear White People, debuted at the Sundance Film Festival in 2014, it was described in more than one review as an Obama-era satire. But more than a year into the Trump era, Dear White People is as relevant as ever. Now it's a Netflix series. The second season just premiered on the streaming site, and it still has a lot to say about race, truth, and what it means to be an American. After finishing up the first season, Justin Simeon says he went back to school in a way, reading up on the history of race relations in America. When we spoke, I asked him why.
Well, I'm always trying to dig down to, like, what is the deeper issue? I think the instinct is that Dear White People is just a topical series of talking points sometimes, but it actually isn't in our heads anyway. The sort of banter and the way they articulate their ideas is kind of the frosting. The actual cake is made up of a character study in one part, but also just a study of human nature, a study of this country. And, you know, one of the things that I desperately needed to see in history was what was happening to me in the present, which is I found myself at the center of these alt-right attacks online, some of which were coming from, you know, armies of fake accounts. And I was trying to get a grasp on what this phenomenon was and why it was so different than when we put the movie out. And the deeper I dig, the more I realize this is actually a kind of a tradition in America to sort of shame the marginalized voice. And the "what do you have to complain about" argument has really gone back since the abolition of slavery. And, you know, I found a kind of kinship with people throughout history in this position and really just tried to bring all of that to bear in the season.
There's an amazing sequence in episode 8 of this season where there are two characters having a very personal conversation about race and about trolling and about identity and appropriation. I want to play a clip from it. It's a little bit long, but I think it's an incredibly important part of season 2. So let's listen to this debate inside the radio station.
So how does it make you feel? The trolling, the blame you're getting for all of this.
It's a part of being on the internet. Like porn or videos of animals that act like people.
It must hurt, though.
Do you want it to hurt?
I just want to know how it makes you feel.
The oppressed are always being blamed for calling out the nature of their oppression.
That's a really good answer to a question, just not my question. How does it feel to be a target?
It hurts. Okay? Is that what you wanted to hear?
It was, actually.
Sadist.
Tim, I'm just wondering if these trolls see you as this invincible badass that they can't get to, so they keep escalating. You know, if people realize...
They want to hurt my feelings. That is the point. Admitting it is giving them what they want.
Why can't you use your platform to tell people how much it hurts? To really be vulnerable?
Who are you to tell me what I should do?
If you were really interested in reaching people, maybe you'd let them in. You'd express yourself honestly. You wouldn't hide behind this veil of anger. It's only a small part of who you are.
I didn't hear a question there.
I'm just saying.
What I heard was a reprimand.
There is so much going on in that scene.
Yeah,
it is a very intense scene, and it's between Sam and Gabe, a black woman and a white guy. I want to hear from you about the writing of that scene, why it's important. I think you directed this episode.
I did.
Tell me, there's so much to unpack. This is a critical scene, I think, to the whole season.
What we wanted to do is to have it out, like the argument that I think so many people try to have in Twitter format, but you're kind of limited by these, you know, character limits, and it puts you in this dynamic where it's just about being right. It's not about hearing each other. And we thought it'd be interesting to just let them have it all out. All of these two incredibly smart, articulate people who are actually on the same side of the issue, but just cannot come together on this particular point, which is the role of, you know, white allyship. And we just thought that one was an interesting argument and conversation that I think America needed to see and, you know, cathartically needed to experience. But also, you know, it was what's happening beneath it is that the two of these have a history and they have a relationship. And frankly, you just think they should just frickin' be together. But there's all of this social construct and, you know, politically charged hurt and epigenetics. I mean, the conversation really gets crazy. All of this stuff in the way from these two people who, if they didn't grow up in this particular time and place in this particular society, would just be hanging out or making out right now. And that's really what the piece is about, is the things that sort of get in between.
But it also seems like it's informed a little bit by all the haterade that was poured on you after the first marketing materials were launched ahead of the launch of the first season. There was some really horrible stuff, and a lot of it was probably bots or fake news, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
But some of it probably meant something to you, and some of it probably got your goat, and some of it made you want to reply.
Definitely when I started to think about it in the context of history, it really, really, it would bring me to tears, because these people I don't think that they fully realize the tradition that they're actually carrying on. It's a tradition that has often turned fatal and violent and has blotted out millions of people's voices. And, you know, I'm lucky that it's just on Twitter for me. It's not like a physical reality when I walk around my neighborhood or something, that people, you know, don't like what I had to say and they're like chasing me down. I mean, this was the experience of most black people for most of the time in this country. And also Jack Moore, you know, he's not here. I hope he doesn't mind me saying this, but, you know, he's a white writer on our staff of, you know, all black writers. And he, oddly enough, got some of the worst hate. And I think because people saw that he was a white guy or something, I'm not sure, but he was, I mean, really, really made a target of this stuff. And I thought it would be interesting to have this conversation play out where it's not really clear who the show is siding with at all, because they both make really, really interesting points.
Coming up, more from Dear White People creator Justin Simien and why he sees his show as an invitation to stop assuming so much about people who aren't like us. Of kindness. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Let's return now to my conversation with Justin Simien about the new second season of Dear White People. It just dropped on Netflix. The show, based on Simien's movie of the same name, follows a group of black students at a fictional, predominantly white Ivy League college called Winchester University. It's a comedy, but it's also not afraid to delve into some very deep social commentary. Justin Simien says he also hopes his show helps generate some empathy.
If you look like my characters or you have experiences like them, you can feel the sense of catharsis and go, oh my God, somebody really sees me. Somebody really gets what I'm feeling. And if you don't look like my characters, that's a joy too, because you get to see yourself in people that maybe you haven't had an opportunity to. And I've said this before, but I think it's apt. Maybe the next time you see a Reggie or a Joelle chilling in a Starbucks, you're not going to call the cops on them, because you've seen yourself in people who look just like them.
And this is something we talked about the last time you came on, and that was when the first season of Dear White People was launching. You talked about how you rapped just as President Trump was elected and what that meant to the series, and how you didn't have to really change anything, because what you were talking about in season one was that we are not living in a post-racial world or post-feminist world. If that was how the first season unfolded against history, how would you position the second season against what's happening in the world?
I mean, I think this season, there's a sense of urgency to diagnose the issue. And I think, like, amnesia, fake news, misinformation, these are all kind of buzzwords, but they describe the American condition to a T. And the more you dig and the more you really look and you sort of get past what you vaguely remember from history class, you realize that there's always been this concerted effort in this country to erase the voices of marginalized people because it makes us feel bad. Honestly, that's what it comes down to. We want to just cut into our Thanksgiving turkey and not think about the genocide that preceded our being here. We want to be like, oh, manifest destiny. God wanted us to have this, but really not deal with any of the consequences of what that meant. We don't want to drill down into the fact that all men are created equal was only about white men who had enough money to own property in this country. That's all it applied to. Nobody else was created equal. That's why nobody else is mentioned. And so, you know, these are the things that we'd rather not look at, but we must because, you know, slavery is a wound in this country. And like Malcolm X said, you don't heal the wound by pretending the knife was never there. You have to address the wound. You can't just pull the knife out. You can't put it away. You have to spend time as a country addressing, focusing on, and healing the wound. And, you know, these things are pathological. They sort of pass on through generations, and they will continue to do so until we take the time to address it.
There are a couple of mentions in the second season of your series of James Baldwin.
Mm-hmm.
Let's listen to one mention that I think comes in the first or second episode of this season.
Baldwin said, to be a Negro and relatively conscious is to be in a rage almost all the time. Well, this is medicinal.
Damn. Alec Baldwin was a genius.
It's James Baldwin, not Alec Baldwin.
It's a good reminder. It is a comedy.
I get that. But Baldwin seems to be a touch point for you. And what James Baldwin says and what he meant and the way he saw the world today, decades before we're living in it, is unbelievable and sad. How do you figure out how to incorporate what James Baldwin felt was important into a series that is comic?
I don't even try. I mean, it's, you know, he's in me. Like, he's helped me anchor myself as a Black queer man in this world and figure out the context with which I'm being seen by the greater America. His work has made this all so much less confusing, you know, maybe sad, maybe it fires me up at times, but he was able to articulate at a time when, frankly, nothing was encouraging him to in this country anyway. Really, the plight of the so-called Negro in this country, all the way from slavery until now. And the thing is that I don't even have to really think about incorporating all of this dark stuff into a so-called comedy because it's all so absurdist. It really is. Like, the more you research about how arbitrary the white ideal standard of beauty is, or even the idea of whiteness and Blackness and the races, I mean, this is all really bad pseudoscience that was sort of concocted by a very small group of people and then kind of went viral. And so it is funny. I mean, when you remove yourself enough from it to laugh at it, it's so absurd. It's, you know, so, and I think what Baldwin was commenting on is how do you deal with the absurdity of race in this country? It makes absolutely no sense, and yet it is a reality for us. So how do you deal with that with a universe that just feels so absurdly off axis? And he helps me sort of anchor myself in what feels like a really chaotic time. He also has a quote which says, you think that your pain is the worst in all the world, and then you read and you have a connection and a kinship with people who've come before you and felt the exact same way. And there is something healing about that.
We're talking with Justin Simeon about the second season of Dear White People. You spent a lot of time in the second season, too, talking about truth and facts. And I checked just before we sat down, the Washington Post has cataloged more than 3,000 lies, fudges, false misleading claims made by President Trump since he became president. And you seem really interested in what is and is not truthful and what is and is not objective. I'm going to play a scene about documentaries from this season where they're talking about what is and is not truthful in nonfiction filmmaking.
I wasn't saying documentaries don't have agendas. I was just saying there are some stories we shouldn't take for granted. Why We Fight tells the truth by way of leaving out many others. Segregation in the army, internment camps. If we take everything people say at face value, we lose our ability to discern truth. Okay?
Okay. Look, why tell me this now and not during the class debate? I wasn't about to fight with the one other sister in the room for their pleasure. Too tropey.
They're talking about Frank Capra's documentary, Why We Fight.
Yeah.
But that's a very important idea for you throughout this season.
Yeah.
It's like, what should we believe? What is truth? And how do you figure out what is actually happening?
I think what she's asking of us in that moment is to always consider the source. It doesn't mean that you should doubt every single thing you've heard. I mean, that is kind of insane at a certain point. You have to accept some things just to get on with your day and have a cup of coffee. But I think that there's a lot of stuff that we take for granted about who we are, what this country is, and how it works, because we've never stopped to really consider the source, or if that source may have a motivation other than just simply informing us. I mean, we take on all of these things that we are told through commercials, through television shows, things we heard on the radio, and it feels so good to be right, and it feels so good to be anchored on something that you know it's true, that we really in many ways don't examine some of these long-held beliefs. And we really need to, because some of them are resulting in a really miserable life in a nation that is supposed to be founded on freedom. And so, you know, yeah, I think it is. I think it's time to think about why. You know, if you disagree with, say, Black Lives Matter or something, maybe it would be a great time to take a minute to really look at what they're about and what they mean and why they're so upset. The reason why these people are mounting these movements is because they're having an experience in this country that needs to be paid attention to. And I would include the alt-right in this. You know, I'm not saying that they are righteous. I think that the experience that they're having that we need to pay attention to, I don't believe that this is a group of people that's being disenfranchised, but I think we need to be paying attention to what it is that's working for them in this time, because I think it tells us a lot about ourselves. One of the things that's so great about Why We Fight, there are many things that's really great about it, but one of the interesting things is you really are discovering with these filmmakers the realization of just how bad the Holocaust was. And you realize that there was this concerted effort in this country and certainly over there to downplay how bad it was so that we didn't have to feel bad and we didn't have to distract from what we're doing over here and go to war. And there's a despair in those films. Like, how could we not see this? And I'm just trying to make that despair a little bit less for us. I think we should just start looking at it now. Let's just rip the Band-Aid off, you know?
And the other thing that you seem interested in doing is not assuming that what we think somebody looks like is what they look like. There's an alt-right troll in this season. I'm not going to tell you who it turns out to be, but it's not who we would assume it would be. And then there's a Ann Coulter-type person who visits campus and is played by a Black actress, Tessa Thompson, who yes. is, of course, in the original movie.
How do you sleep at night?
Indica-dominant hybrid. And keeping in mind that I'm stacking these checks so I can build a goddamn kingdom of my own. Because in this country, all that matters is who holds the gold and owns the land and its many resources.
So what are you interested in doing there in terms of examining the way that we would assume somebody like that looks like?
Well, again, it's about looking closely and considering the source. I think that the so-called model minority concept is really contagious in this country. And it all always stems back to whiteness and slavery. I know. I'm like a broken record. But it really does. And the way you sort of understand someone like Candace Owens or Omarosa or the woman whose name I'm forgetting, but she is a prominent anti-Muslim Muslim, we really were interested in how these people end up in these positions. And I think that the sort of problem that we're all having is that we are all very quick to assume. We're quick to assume that we know exactly who we're talking to. We're quick to assume that we understand their motivations and what they want from us. And we don't do a lot of listening. And I think that whenever it's someone you don't expect or there's some aspect of a person that you didn't see coming, it's sort of a wake-up call for you in the narrative to stop assuming. This is an area where we need to stop doing so much assuming. You know, it's particularly when it comes to race and cultivating an empathy towards people who are not quite like us.
Justin, great to see you.
You too. I love your show. I listen to it every day.
Oh, thanks. The second season of Dear White People is now available on Netflix. As the broadcast and cable networks prepare for their crucial presentations to advertisers next week, they have a new worry, and that is YouTube's foray into the original content game. Last Friday, YouTube debuted Cobra Kai. It's a sequel to Karate Kid with original star Ralph Macchio. The first episode has already generated more than 20 million views, and YouTube today announced it has approved a second season for the series. The platform has more plans up its sleeve, but it's still trying to regain advertiser trust after allowing ads to run next to offensive YouTube videos. Natalie Jarvie of The Hollywood Reporter attended YouTube's presentation to advertisers last week, and I asked her how YouTube responded to the backlash about ads and offensive content.
This time in 2017, YouTube really had to come out and apologize to their advertisers for allowing some of their ad spots to stream alongside of violent, insensitive, racist content that had all kind of spurred last year by a very public incident involving their top star, PewDiePie. And he had made some kind of anti-Semitic jokes. There were advertisements that ran alongside some of those videos, and YouTube had to apologize.
So what are they selling this year if they have tried to and maybe done some work to clean up their act? What's their new message right now?
Well, I was kind of expecting them to come out and have to apologize again, and they didn't do that. They owned the last year that they've had, the struggles that they've had to continue to try to find ways to clean up content. I mean, since the incident involving PewDiePie last winter, they've had to take down, you know, extremist content, exploitative children's content, fake news. And instead of apologizing, they really came out and said, listen, we know that this is a problem. We're working on it. They also acknowledged that they now have 1.8 billion, that's billion with a B, logged in users. And with that kind of scale comes a lot of challenges to moderate their content. And they then ticked off the number of ways that they're trying to course correct.
A lot of that is about user-generated content. And one of the things that YouTube is trying to do is create its own content. So on that latter front, what were some of the ideas that they were selling advertisers? And how important is that original content to YouTube's future?
Original content is going to be the thing that YouTube can show its advertising partners as an example of the brand safe content that they can support. So it's very important to the future of YouTube continuing to, you know, get more advertising budgets flowing their direction. What's interesting about what they announced this year is that they're really focusing on well-known, trusted names. The shows that they announced were from the likes of Will Smith and Priyanka Chopra and LeBron James. They were not talking about shows that their homegrown YouTubers are creating.
Are they in some ways trying to kind of reposition YouTube? Because I think a lot of people, and maybe advertisers included, have a certain image in their mind of what YouTube does and does not do. Are they really trying to pivot away from YouTube's past and try to chart a new future?
Absolutely. You know, one of their top executives, Robert Kinsel, spent a number of years at Netflix. And you can see his roots at Netflix in some of the moves that YouTube has made. In addition to their ad-supported platform, a couple of years ago they launched a subscription service called YouTube Red. It's all part of this larger effort by YouTube to showcase that there is premium content available on their platform and that viewers are going to sit down and watch 30 minutes of a show on YouTube as opposed to, you know, the music videos or, you know, 3 to 5 minute clips that you think of when you think of YouTube.
If you think about some of the shows that they've announced with Will Smith and with Ralph Macchio from Karate Kid, they seem to be not just conservative, but kind of old school, kind of blast from the past type characters. Was that your take on their push as well, that these are not really cutting edge artists, but kind of people that we might be familiar with and maybe haven't checked in with in a long time?
This is part of a focus by YouTube over the last year or so to age up their audience. Everyone knows YouTube has millennials and Gen Z audiences. That's a given. Now YouTube wants to show we can attract adults too. And so something like Karate Kid, that's a beloved property for people over the age of 30 or 35. And they're very much trying to lure those viewers to their service with a show like that.
I mean, it's very odd for somebody in the content business to try to make its audience older. How important is YouTube to Google and parent company Alphabet? Do we know how much money they make or how much they are contributing to the bottom line?
We don't. Google, Alphabet give very little information about how much money YouTube is bringing into the business. There's always some comment on their earnings call where they'll say something like, you know, revenue was up so much percent, you know, driven in part by YouTube. And that's about all we get. So we don't know, but we know that they're a huge advertising business. And despite the challenges that they've had over the last year and some very public demonstrations by some brands to pull back spending on the platform in response to kind of the unsafe brand environment, we know that that hasn't really impacted Google's bottom line. If it had, we would be seeing that somewhere in the earnings, and we're not.
And did you get any sense for how advertisers reacted to the new push from YouTube, whether or not they're willing to kind of put their toes back in the water, even if they've been burned in the last year or so?
Procter & Gamble announced that they're returning to the platform. They're a huge advertiser for YouTube, and their show of support says a lot. It shows that advertisers are willing to work with YouTube to kind of get through this rocky period, and that they're still supportive. At Brandcast, Kellogg's got up there and talked about how they're working with YouTube. So it definitely seems like brands are willing to kind of stick by YouTube's side during this time.
Natalie Jarvie is the digital media editor at The Hollywood Reporter. She joined us from New York. Natalie, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, John.
And that's it for The Frame today. I'm John Horn. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You will find us at The Frame. Thanks for listening. I'll see you back here tomorrow. We'll